sermon by explaining some event or a couple of events that took place in church history. And you'll see as I go along how this all ties in with today's feast day as we make progress through this particular point. The area, or era, if you wish, of church history I'd like to review today is in the time of the 14th century. It was a very turbulent time in the church, probably after the persecutions up until that time in church history. There had not been such great turmoil in the church as there was during the 14th century, the 1300s. During that particular time, the church saw herself divided in several ways. One was divided in the actual place of where it is that the Pope should live and reside. If you remember anything of points of church history, you remember that there was what was called the Avignon or Babylonian captivity, when because of political unrest in Italy, the popes had to leave from Rome, and they found shelter and refuge by a king and some noblemen in southern France in a town called Avignon, and there built a huge palace and stayed there for about 70 years, ruling the church from France. That didn't come to an end until about 1378. It might have gone on longer than that had not St. Catherine of Siena approached the Pope and said, "You belong back in Rome. You are the vicar of Christ. You belong to rule the church back where the chair of Peter is and where Peter was." And so the Pope worked toward, and then by 1378, like I said, he found his way back to Rome. This was Pope Gregory the 11th at that particular time. The sad thing is that even it should be a joyful time and a very peaceful time for the church to have this point of unity all starting to be restored. Within a year, another great crisis erupted in the church. In about a year's period of time, Pope Gregory the 11th had died, and they came together in conclave to elect the next pope, just as we often see in church history how the elections of popes take place. Must have been something. You know, we think of conclaves being with, you know, 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 people, 100 men being present. In this particular case, I don't think there was any more than 11, such it was as the church at that particular time. Anyway, these 11 men gathered together in Rome to elect a pope. But the Roman people were insisting to these cardinals that when you elect a pope, you'd better make sure he's an Italian this time. We're tired of having Frenchmen rule over the church, because that had been in Avignon. It had been a few French popes that had been there. And you can imagine that being, you know, and you go back in church history, and hard to think that people would rise up and start threatening them. I mean, they actually did threaten the cardinals who were there trying to elect the pope. They threatened them in such a way, saying, if you do not elect a Roman, or if not a Roman, at least an Italian, if you don't do that, then you'd better watch out for your safety when you come out of there, and so forth. I mean, it even got so far to the point that they marched through the streets and were chanting there, you know, there will be dangerous times for if you do not elect the right man. And then even at one point, they broke into the very building where the conclave was taking place, all to make sure they were going to elect at least an Italian, if not a Roman. Well, these cardinals got so frightened at that particular point when the people, this mob, had broken in, that they quickly elected this one who had been in one of the papal offices in Avignon, well known, and he was an Italian to boot, so that's what made it good. Elected him, showed that these things that were the obedience they would give to him, and presented him to the people and said, here is the new pope, Urban VI. Everybody recognized him, that he was Italian, everything was fine, the crowds quietened down, and thus it went on. The cardinals showed their obedience toward him, and the church continued to go on after that. What started to change, though, was they started to recognize that this Urban fellow was not quite the easygoing man as he had been in France. If you go back into that period of church history, there was great need for reform for taking place, reform among the clergy. There was immorality and quite a few other problems that there were. And Pope Urban VI took it upon himself to be a great reforming pope. And he got rather strict at that time, which made some of these other cardinals who weren't quite ready for that strictness to happen start to wonder and said, who is it? You know, what did we do here by electing this man? What have we done wrong? A couple of them got the idea, well, we only elected him because we were afraid. If we didn't elect him, then we were probably going to be killed. And so they got it into their head here and saying, well, Maybe that fear that we had at that time caused that election to be invalid, because if anything is done out of fear, can't be done validly. It's a principle of moral theology and sacramental theology too. So that's how they started to look at it, a few of them anyway. And that idea started to gather up steam to the point that a majority of those cardinals withdrew their obedience from Urban VI, deposed him, said that his election wasn't valid because it was done under fear, held their own conclave at another place, and elected a new man, Clement VII. And that caused the greater tragedy. The Avignon, the Babylonian captivity, was bad. This was worse, because now you had a confusion of authority. Who do we obey? Both sides seem to have good claims to validity here. Whether one was done out of fear. If it was done out of fear, then this one here was deposed because it probably wasn't a valid election, and so now we've elected someone validly. And then Urban VI deposed all those men and elected his whole new college of cardinals that he had there in Rome. And because some great turmoil was taking place and such great confusion was happening, that Clement VII and his college of cardinals and other people who were following him all fled back to France to that big building that had been in Avignon that had housed them for 70 years. And so from that point on, actually for the next 40 years, there was this confusion of obedience, a terrible time in the church, a time of great division, and even a time when the enemies of the church made the best progress against the church because there was so much division in there. Now, all that being said, that this division, this schism over who was in authority, as terrible as it was, we can say this part of it in church history, that there was no attempt to change any doctrines of the faith. There were good people on both sides of these obediences. I mean, at one particular point, toward the close of this great Western schism, a third man came along with legitimate claims to be a pope. So you had three men at one point claiming to be a pope, just adding to the whole confusion of things. But even with all that confusion, there was no changing of doctrine. There was no attempt by any of these men to change the doctrines of the church, much like what we see taking place in our times here. What made this time so terrible amongst us, such a great crisis and a sadness in the church, is that you had good people on both sides in these obediences. You had saints on both sides, saints who worked miracles on both sides of this obedience here. And you would think at this particular point that everyone would work as quickly as they could to heal that schism, because any type of division in the church is not good in the church at all. If the church is the physical representation of the mystical body of Christ, Christ's body is not rent in two. His church should not be torn in two either, nor with this confusion of obediences. There has to just be one voice, one leader, not two, not three. Let's move ahead in history beyond this time, after these two elections that took place within months apart, to 10 years later. Pope Urban VI is coming close to death, and he's bothered by the idea that the union has not taken place in the church that everyone said they wanted. Oh, everybody mouthed it. Everybody said, we have to have unity. We've got to work together. But nobody actually worked for it, because it was hard to do. Hard work to accomplish these things, hard work to sit down and come to some particular point of unity and uniting and taking place. And that they wouldn't do. So Pope Urban VI did what most good Catholics do in time of great crisis. They turned to the Blessed Virgin Mary, because she has been hailed ever since the beginning of Christianity as the one who gives us particular aid and comfort in times of great sorrow, in times of great crisis and tragedy that can take place. And so he not only turned to her in prayer, but he established a special feast day around the mystery of the visitation today. In 1389, Pope Urban VI established the feast of the Visitation of the Blessed Virgin Mary to be celebrated every year on July 2nd. That when he established it for one purpose, that all would pray on that day to bring the schism to an end through the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary. She has protected the church, her son's church. She will protect it again. These were all the things that he had done. He went so far as to impress upon everybody that this was such an important duty for everybody to pray for, that they had to pray for an end of the schism. If they didn't do that, it would never end. Because God will not favor them with an end of the schism, an end of this great crisis, until they show God that they want this to come to an end, that they realize this is a great crisis, and they want it to be taken away. God will not move at that point. God can move. He is God. He can have miracles. They can take place. But why should he do it if his people aren't ready for it, if they're not showing they're worthy of it? And so what he established with this feast was not just the feast day, but the day before was a day of fast and abstinence, a vigil. The Feast of Visitation in his time was a holy day of obligation. And then he had an octave, 8 days afterwards, as we see for some major feasts, all for the purpose of prayer and sacrifice for an end to the schism. Now, all the people in his obedience, his line of authority, followed that. The others didn't. And even though all those in his line of obedience did observe the Feast of the Visitation then and prayed for an end of the schism, it seems that some did not pray as fervently as they should. Pope Urban VI dies, his successor is done, his successor promises to work toward an end of the schism. The schism goes on another 10 years, another 20. It's now 30 years since it began, and it looks like there is no end in sight. Finally, by 35 years since the schism began, finally some of the people got tired of this. They started to feel what this crisis was all about. As St. Robert Bellarmine says when he writes the history of the Great Western Schism, he says, finally the people started to realize that our mother, the church, was wounded as a result of this schism. And the only way, besides God's grace, that this wound is going to be healed, is if everyone joined together in prayer and sacrifice to actually work to bring that schism to an end. Not just talk about it, but actually work toward it. And it doesn't matter if it's hard, because it's an important duty, it must be done. 35 years. And yet the historians all say that at that 35-year point, when people finally started to get it up here, when they finally started to get it, that this schism was not the right thing to have. At this particular point, the University of Paris, a great Catholic theologian think tank for Europe at that time, they came up with a solution to this whole thing, how to end the schism. Their solution? Have a pope for every country. We're not going to solve it any other way, they said. And what's the big deal if we have a pope for every country? Big deal? Christ only established the church under one successor to Peter, not one for every country. Takes away the universal nature of the church. That's not a solution. Any thinking Catholic should see that. But nevertheless, it was a theory that was floated around at that time. But after 35 years, when people started now to realize this was a crisis, started now to feel it in themselves, just how bad this crisis was, started now to change their lives, every one of them, to live as the Catholics they should be, to prove to God that they were worthy to have this schism lifted in his church. 35 years had to go by before people started feeling that way, and it took another 5 years after that before steps were taken to end the schism. Boy. Until the Council of Constance met in 1414, and that dragged on for 4 years. But until that council met, the steps were not taken to fully end the schism, solidly bring it to an end. Some of the things that were done were not correct, not dogmatically or by canon law correct. Nevertheless, that's the method that God used to bring an end to this schism. And one of the things, when it did, they had all three men, because there were three popes, the three men who claimed to be pope at this time, had them all resign from their offices, and they elected a fourth man, completely different man, Pope Martin V. And so the church looked like at this particular point it would start to resurrect. But then how would you know? How would you know that the healing from this schism was actually going to be accomplished? It wasn't until the 42nd session of that council, 4 years into it. At the 42nd session of the Council of Constance, the whole thing, that session was all about the Feast of the Visitation, giving recognition to the Blessed Virgin Mary for through her intercession for bringing an end to the schism and establishing this feast day, July 2nd, the Feast of Visitation, to be celebrated throughout the entire church by all Catholics on this day for the purpose no longer of praying for the end of the schism, but praying that such a schism will never happen again in the church. That's the spirit that's supposed to be in our heart this day as we say our prayers. But why the visitation? Why this mystery of the rosary? Why this mystery in Mary's life that we find the gospel story as read today? Why this one? There are other ones, think life of our Lord, that probably could have been suggested as points for healing the schism. Why? Well, when you think about it, this mystery occurs right after the Annunciation. Mary has been invited and has accepted the invitation to be the Mother of God. Christ is now within her womb. She has heard from the angel that her cousin, her elderly cousin Elizabeth, is with child. And even though Mary is now with child, she knows that her cousin needs her. And so just as the Annunciation shows forth to us that with Christ now, the Son of God, present in the womb of Mary, there is starting to begin a reconciliation between God and man, there is now a reconciliation, or at least a point to show how far we must go in order to heal wounds, for reconciliation to take place, for brother upon brother to be together, and to always bring Christ to us in these meetings. And that's in this mystery that Mary goes the great journey to a little town called Ein Kerem, southwest of Jerusalem, and there to see her cousin. But the interesting thing, part of this, is that when she goes to that town, there are two paths she could have taken. One, down the River Jordan, and then up the hill country to round past Jerusalem, and then through Jerusalem and over to Ein Kerem. That's the safest. It's longer, but it's the safest journey. Or the ones which she did take, which takes her through Samaria, a land with robbers, a land with people who are schismatics, who are deathly against the Jews, and often persecute them as they go through, a very dangerous path. Even though Mary was traveling along with a caravan at that particular point, still, she took that path because it was the safest, it was the shortest, because whenever a duty in charity must be done, it must be done swiftly and not put off. All of these things, the Pope said and more, are the reasons why the Feast, the Visitation, was chosen as the mystery for us to pray for when it came to the healing of the schism. Now we come to our time. We come to our age. The Great Western Schism in events in history was a very terrible time at that period of time. You can read in the documents what people said who lived in that period of time, who said this is the worst history, the worst thing that could ever take place, that it's very possible the world will come to an end, that it seemed impossible that the schism would ever end, but it did. More terrible times were ahead for the church after the Great Western Schism, and some historians say because of the Great Western Schism. Because there was such a great division taking place, the enemies of the church made great advances at that point too. Heresy became more rampant. Within a few years after that, the first of the heresies leading up to the defection of Martin Luther and the whole Protestant Reformation all began at that point. Islam made its greatest advance across northern Africa, almost all the way into Spain, during this time of the Great Western Schism, when Catholics were too occupied with themselves about being divided. The Reformation was a great crisis in the church. But we live in an even more terrible crisis, the worst time of crisis than perhaps even the Great Western Schism and the Reformation combined. We live in an age when modernism has affected the church. One of the things we said about during the Great Western Schism, that even though there was a confusion of obedience, and that was the crisis for that time, there was no doctrines being changed. Here, there's not only the crisis about trying to whether we should obey a heretic or not, and heretical doctrines that are proposed to us, not only are those things coming forth to us here, but we see the very doctrines of the church being changed. And the worst part of it here, with all these things, is that Catholics will say, we should just go ahead and accept that. After all, the Pope can do whatever he wants. He's the Pope. He's been fully in charge. Isn't that what they taught at the Vatican Council I in 1870? The Pope is infallible. He can do what he wants. No, it's not. No council, no Pope has the right or the power to change the infallible teachings of the Church, that deposit of faith that was given to the apostles and brought to our time. No one has the right or power. That, according to the modernists, they will go ahead and do it and just say, well, we're just going to do it because doctrine evolves after all. That's the crisis we live in today. That people will start to measure the good Catholicism by believing and following error. They have a wrongful worship that takes place in there and believe they are worshiping God in doing that. Believing they're being obedient. When in all these things, they're going contrary to the centuries of tradition of the Church. Are we in a time of crisis? Yes. Is our time of crisis worse than it ever has been before? Yes. Do all of us know that? No. I truly don't believe that. I truly don't believe that all of us understand the nature of the crisis that we are in. If we all did, then every one of us would be praying and sacrificing and changing our lives to prove to God that we are worthy for Him to intercede and bring this crisis to an end. Some of you have to travel long distances to come to Mass. I hope it's not just because you like Latin, but it's because of the faith. Do you feel the sting of the crisis as you do that? I have to travel long distances at times to bring the Mass to people. There are long hours I have to spend in answering people's email from across the world because other priests won't do that. And these people need answers. They need direction from priests. Yesterday I was on email to somebody in Singapore, somebody in India, three from Europe, four from the United States, and one from Canada. These are all things that must be done. Do we feel the crisis? Do we understand it? Remember, during the Great Western Schism, they did not come out of that schism until they understood everyone was in a crisis and that they had to change. They had to change their way of life. They needed to pray and sacrifice. That everything had to be done to move the heart of God to give the grace somehow, some way, for the pathway out of that crisis. I do not believe we are all there yet. Until everyone on the face of the earth today who claims to be traditional Catholic lives according to that principle, we're going to remain in this crisis for a long, long time. It is not a solution. Remember I told you about the solution the University of Paris came up in the Great Western Schism. Have a pope for every country. It is not part of the solution out of this crisis to go and unite with the sources of error in modern Rome today. It is not. No thinking Catholic should see that. Because Catholics know we don't compromise with error, saying that by that compromise we are going to somehow come to a truth. It is not a pathway out of this crisis for lay people to rise up and start anathematizing everybody because you don't believe the way they say, not what the Church says, but the way they say to accept things. And these lay people have no standing in the Church. That is not the pathway out of the crisis. These people do not understand the crisis that we are in. They are coming to a solution of it that is way off in the, off in every way. And as long as all that exists, as long as all that continues, God will not hear our prayers to end this crisis in the Church, to bring us back to a time of comfort. I pray for you young people today. I pray a lot for you, but especially today. You've never known the Church as it was before. I barely know it. I barely knew it before the Council. But you don't, except through history books and what other people tell you. you may have to continue to keep the faith strong and alive in this period of crisis, for God alone knows how long, unless all of us start working and praying and sacrificing toward an end to the crisis. And so here's what I suggest. Every time you pray the second joyful mystery of the rosary, the mystery in which we reflect on the visitation of the Blessed Virgin Mary, pray for the church. Remember the church. Pray for an understanding of just how bad this crisis is, and that until we all understand it, until we all get it, just how bad this crisis is right now, God will not be moved. Pray through the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary, who is called the vanquisher of all heresies, that the heretics will be overcome, and that right order will be established in the church, true peaceful authority established in the church again, right doctrine taught publicly, and true respect brought back to the church in that way. You know, we pray after Mass for the liberty and exaltation of Holy Mother Church. You bet. We need to pray that every day. That's our obligation. Our Lady told us at Fatima, there will be crises, there will be wars that will take place, but in the end, my Immaculate Heart will triumph. A little glimmer of hope has been given to us. This crisis will come to an end. But when? That's the question. And that's the question you and I have to answer. To give us another glimmer of hope, you know, because some people say, Father, how do I know this is going to work? I mean, I want to pray, I want to understand this, but I just need some hope here that it's going to happen. Okay, let's go for another event that happened in church history. In 1849, there was an important event that took place in Rome. For a few years now, Pius IX, who was Pope at that time, was not reigning from Rome. He was actually reigning from a place in Switzerland. He had to flee to Switzerland a few years before because of the riots that had taken place by the Freemasons and others who were there. In fact, one person tried to assassinate Pope Pius IX, and the bullet that was meant for him actually went a little bit wide and hit his Secretary of State and killed him on the spot. At that point, the Pope fled out of Rome and went to Switzerland for a few years until things were settled down in Rome again. But God knows, and the Pope knew, that Rome was the place he needed to lead. It was not going to be another Avignon captivity, this time in Switzerland. He was doing all he could to get back to Rome to rule the church from there, because that's where the Pope belonged. And so he did go back. Everything worked. He prayed to Our Lady. He prayed the rosary. He encouraged everybody else to do that, to pray the rosary for the restoration of the papacy back where it should be. And you know what happened? And you know the day it happened? To give you some measure of hope, give you some understanding that God is pointing some direction here for us with this idea of the Feast of the Visitation. On July 2nd, 1849, Pope Pius IX walked back into Rome and took back up the rule of the church. And after that, we were gifted with strong popes and strong leadership until the very time of the crisis that we have today. And the only reason we have the crisis today is because people got too lax in their faith and knowledge and understanding of things. And when the modernists would come along and teach error, people would not recognize the error for what it was. When you pray the second decade of the rosary, remember the church. Remember that we are in a time of crisis. Pray that it is a time of crisis. Understand that principle, that God will lift it from us. And in his time, it would laugh and be lifted. You know, it's up to us either way. Either we understand this is a time of crisis, we pray and act like that, we change our lives and act like that so that God will move and help his church, or we just continue along the path that we're doing right now, pretending there is no crisis, coming to Mass on occasion, praying on occasion, using confession as a crutch, not as a source of grace. And then God will not be moved when we do that to help his church. So I lay it before you now on this feast, the Visitation. I lay it before you and before all Catholics in the world. If we want out of this crisis, this is the pathway. Either we do this, we live and act like it until God moves, or we go this way. And if we go that other path, the way we're going right now, because most people just don't get it that we're in a period of crisis right now, then it's our own fault. This crisis.